Thank you for tuning into the KBOO Food Show. I'm Kate Welch. Today we will hear the latest news about the Farm Bill from Julia DeGraw. We will talk to Courtney Dillard and Matthew Weber about their upcoming tour of America, Eating Breakfast with Strangers, and Bruce Silverman's interview with radical feminist Leo Keith about her book, The Vegetarian Myth. Julia DeGraw is in the studio. She's the Northwest organizer for the Food and Water Watch organization. You might recognize her from last December when she recorded an interview with me about the 2012 Farm Bill. Today, she's giving us the latest update. Welcome to KBOO again, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
And the U.S. Senate's been voting on over 70 amendments to the bill this week. What's the latest news from Congress?
Well, the good news about the Farm Bill is that it's not as bad as it could have been.
Tell us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the 2012 version of the Farm Bill that they're reviewing right now in the Senate doesn't have as many cuts to programs that we were really concerned about as we kind of expected. A lot of the food stamps and food assistance and nutritional programs didn't get as big of cuts as we were expecting. And there are some really great amendments out there that we're hoping to see passed. And there's a couple of amendments out there that we're actually trying to fight as well. And we got some good news on the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. That's the SNAP program. It sounds like the Senate just passed that amendment to refund that program, which is really important. The good news is that as far as the Senate version is concerned, there is not as much damage as we were expecting. However, it's not some, you know, transformative farm bill that we would, of course, ultimately hope for, but this is a very long-term battle to get a farm bill that works for, you know, consumers and for farmers.
And so this is one step along the way. And the Senate is voting on these amendments, but then they still have to vote on the entire bill, and then it has to go to Congress. Do you know what their time schedule is? Is there anything that we should be keeping our eyes on?
Yeah, so usually, I mean, there is no usual anymore, really, when it comes to the Farm Bill. Every single time it has to be reauthorized, it happens in new and different ways. So there really is no more usual. But in the past, it's usually gone through the House first. This is a strange year in that it's going through the Senate first. The House seems to be really sitting back to see what happens in the Senate. If it continues to move forward in the Senate, and it looks like they may actually pass it or move on it, which is a big deal. Often bills don't really, a lot doesn't happen during election years, people are, you know, in Congress. So if the Farm Bill doesn't get mucked up in the Senate, then it looks like the House will probably mark up their own version of the Farm Bill, and then they'll have to reconcile those two versions is how it always ends up going. But it's so early in the process that it's too early to say whether it's actually going to move or not, because we don't know.
You never know what's going to happen.
But if it were not to move forward this year, they would probably end up reauthorizing the past Farm Bill, because otherwise it would revert back to laws from the 1940s that would really create, frankly, a more fair market for farmers, and would be a big blow to Big Ag. So we know that rather than going back to that far back into time, they're going to probably just reauthorize the past Farm Bill for a short period of time, you know, for a few months, and have to go back to it in a few months.
And that would not necessarily be what we want to see either.
No, exactly. that would not be a step in the right direction.
So over the past decades, the Farm Bill has been working for big corporate farmers. Is there something in the bill working for small farmers this time? Vegetable growers and such?
Right. It really, as I said, there isn't as much damage to programs we want to protect as we were expecting. So the stuff that we like in the current Farm Bill is generally still going to be there. There are some amendments that we do like that we hope pass, but we don't know if they're going to pass. But there are some amendments. There's an amendment that would increase competition with the the packers. It's called the Packers Ban, and basically it would make sure that there's meat packers can't have a monopoly in the market, and it would really increase the price that farmers could get for their livestock if we got a packer ban. So that's an amendment that we're hoping will pass that will basically increase competition within the livestock market. We also have an amendment that require GE labeling, genetically engineered food labeling, and that would be huge if it passed. And there's another amendment that we also really like that would allow organic farmers to file civil suits against big ag companies if their crops are contaminated by genetically engineered foods as well. So there's a lot of amendments that we really support and would love to see passed.
Are there any that you focus on not seeing passed, or is that not something that Food and Water Watch does?
Oh yeah, we're definitely working hard on the Hill to stop. Senator McCain has an amendment that would basically make it so that fish would not have to be inspected like meat, which I mean, there's just nothing logical about that.
Because they glow in the dark,
right? There literally isn't a logic behind it that I can think of, and so less inspection is definitely not something that our system needs, especially of our fish products when you consider everything, you know, all the contaminants that are in the oceans and rivers. And then there's another amendment that would rid the organic certification cost share program, and obviously we don't want to do anything to reduce support of organic programs, and that would be Senator Toomey's amendment that we are working on making sure doesn't get passed. So those are two of the big ones that we really don't want to see passed. And we, of course, want to make sure that food assistance programs and nutritional programs and the organic programs, like, you know, people want to grow food, not commodity crops. We want to make sure that those programs are as supported as possible.
Right. And that hungry people can continue to get some assistance and some good food for their...
Yeah, if anything, they need more assistance, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, the last
yeah.
thing we need is to see cuts in those programs.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of overwhelming to look at these amendments. Listeners might be interested in a website that I've found. The farmbillprimer.org has all of the Senate Farm Bill amendments, and there's 70 of them. And it's, you know, if you've got a half a day or more, or if you're particularly interested, you know, this is important stuff. And quickly or briefly, Julia, why is the food bill so important? I know we've covered this on this program, and on I've heard Barbara Bernstein cover it also, but.
Well, I would also say if you don't have half a day to look through this website, Food and Water Watch has a Farm Bill 101 primer, basically, that outlines all of the amendments that we are fighting for and the amendments that we are fighting against. And so it's a really quick one-pager that we've already sifted through the 70-some-odd amendments, and we've found the ones that people should really be concerned about. And so you can go to foodandwaterwatch.org and look up the Farm Bill 101 handout, and it's a great resource.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the Farm Bill, yeah, I mean, I'm glad you called it the food bill. It really regulates how food gets to your plate. If you're concerned about what goes into your body, or even if you're not concerned about what goes into your body, we need to make sure that the food that you're eating is safe and nutritious, and the Farm Bill controls every aspect of how that food gets to your plate, whether it's regulating how much and what kind of crops farmers should be planting, to really determining the competition within the system, as well as it really just basically regulates every step of the process of how food ends up on your plate. So it's something that we should all be very concerned about and fighting for, a better farm bill that actually works for farmers and for consumers, not for corporations.
Yeah. Is there something else that it's important for our listeners to know about this farm bill and the legislation that's happening right now?
Well, this is not so much farm bill related, but it's politically related. It's something to just keep in mind is that during, you know, election years like this one, it's general knowledge that, Congress doesn't tend to do a lot during election years. They're afraid to pass things so if the farm bill actually moves, we can really anticipate, some potentially really bad legislation or attachments to the farm bill that we should keep an eye on. That's definitely one danger about, the farm bill, process, is that there can be, a lot of attachments to the farm bill that are something that would be really bad for people. So,
and there's a couple out there, and I don't remember the specifics of them, but a couple of them have been rejected already, and they are things that have nothing to do with food.
Exactly. I mean, that's what's kind of scary about this process, is that you can you can really tag anything onto the farm bill. And it's been known to happen, numerous times in omnibus bills in the past where they, have attached all sorts of, you know, kooky amendments that have nothing to do with whatever the bill is. And that's, they're just basically, taking advantage of the fact that the farm bill is so important that they're forcing senators to vote for something they would never support just to get a farm bill reauthorized. And that's what's, it's a big flaw in the process, frankly, and that's something that we should be wary of. But the other thing that's, of course, a possibility is it doesn't move at all. And that's, you know, that's a distinct possibility given, you know, the effectiveness of our Congress right now.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like in 1940 when you say that if everything failed, we'd go back to the 1940 bill?
Basically, Big Ag took over the farm bill in the last, you know, few decades. So 1940, we actually had a farm bill that was fair. I mean, it was a lot more fair. I'm not going to say it was perfect, but it basically ensured a lot more competition within the market. And when there's more competition, farmers get a fair price. So, and it also would require a lot of the anti-monopoly laws to be actually enforced, which would be huge.
Maybe we should be rooting for it.
I know. I'm kind of, I mean, the thing is it would never happen. I mean, that's, you know, Congress is never going to let it revert to the 1940 system. So they'll just reauthorize the 2008 Farm Bill and keep going.
Keep big business in there.
Yeah. So we've got our work cut out for us, but Food and Water Watch knows that this is a long-term campaign. You're not going to get the Farm Bill, you know, transformed in one session. So we'll just try to protect what's good and continue working on improving the Farm Bill each time out.
It's a lifetime process.
It really is.
So thank you very much for coming into KBOO this morning, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning into the KBOO Food Show. Also joining me in the studio today is a young couple who's about to embark on a cross-country honeymoon tour of America, incorporating a book project titled Breakfast with Strangers. You might recognize Courtney Dillard because she's a former KBOO News volunteer, and with her is Matthew Weber, soon-to-be husband and partner in this project, where you take a stranger to breakfast. Welcome to KBOO, Courtney and Matt.
Thanks for having
us. Yeah, thanks for having us.
So when I first saw the articles about you splashed all over the local media, I thought, wow, these two really know how to market themselves. And now we have these wonderful little cards. Kurt says, oh, we need these for KBOO. But then, Courtney, I see that you're teaching media at Willamette University?
Yes. I teach in the Rhetoric and Media Studies department there.
Ah, and so you're practicing what you teach?
A little bit. I think that one of the impetuses or impeti for this project is the idea that I encounter students all the time, and they have a pretty narrow sense of community, even though we get the sense that the online community is so huge. I don't think they really envision getting to know people outside of their box. And so I have a lot of conversations with them about what community is and about what it means to build community and relations with others. So I would say that my work has definitely a link to what Matt and I are up to this summer.
And so then that inspired you to kind of build a community of breakfast eaters or to try what, you know.
I think that part, and then it's interesting, Matt can speak to this, but Matt's work as well, with community organizing and kind of seeing what change comes about when people who don't know each other but believe in the same thing can come together, and how important that is actually to forward our political lives and, to build a society.
Mm-hmm. So, how are you choosing? How do you choose breakfast companions?
Well, it certainly hasn't been easy because since we put it out on a couple of online communities and with a little bit of press that we've had close to about 600 breakfast requests come in.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and this is from all over the country. So, you know, it's really just looking for trying to find out where that nugget is that we can develop out of the story. And it's not really the most interesting or the craziest story that people send us. You know, we had an entrepreneur in Western Kentucky who is, you know, managing a Chick-fil-A right now as he's trying to live out his American dream to develop his product. Or you have the single dad who's managing a roller skating rink in Ohio. I mean, there's all these different interesting stories out there. And, you know, we're just kind of going through the first sift and just trying to go from there.
So are you going to choose people's stories that you kind of like, or are you going to say, well, we're going to be in this town today, or we might make this town? I mean, you're actually going to plan out your route.
you know, right now it's kind of like the first wave to get the idea of who are the great folks out there that we really want to make sure to go out of our way to meet. But, you know, we've got a plan to snake the northern part of the country to Portland, Maine, and then snake back on the southern route all the way back to Portland in about a little over 5 months.
5 months, wow.
But, you know, once we hit the road, just let serendipity kind of take over and guide us. And it's great that we have all these responses, but part of this project is breaking through the wall and meeting strangers. And so we need to be brave ourselves and really grab that person who's about to go into a diner and say, hey, want to sit down
with
us? That's
just what I was wondering, if that would be how you do it. Because mm-hmm. who knows where you're going to be? You know, you have bad weather, you have a nice day, you want to go for a long hike, and you're not where you maybe planned. Mm-hmm. So you just grab a stranger.
That's the hope. And that's how this all started, was just Courtney being brave and seeing somebody sit at a counter and saying, we should really have them over at the table.
And how did that person respond? You know, what happened?
Yeah, well, it was in Northeast Portland, and we just got to talking with a person. We were actually sitting up at the counter, and he was maybe two stools away. And, you know, we were just sitting ourselves talking, and he was just sitting by himself. And I thought, what an opportunity. Who knows what this person, you know, what their story is. And so how difficult is it just to turn to that person and say, are you enjoying your breakfast? So that started about a 45-minute hour conversation about what he was up to, what we were up to. And it was the perfect example about why I think this is going to be such a rich project, because his story, this random person sitting next to us, was that he had been spending about 2 years working on a sailboat that he wanted to sail around, probably not around the world, but around whatever his itinerary was, and that he came there, I think, every Saturday or what have you, for breakfast after he had been working on the boat. And so we ended up talking to him about that vision, and we bought his breakfast, and it was the first light bulb that went on, that there was something really rich in not just having breakfast with one another. Matt and I see each other quite a bit in the world, but to broaden that conversation would be an enriching thing to do.
Are you going to do any camping along the way to where you have that campsite breakfast?
You could make
your own breakfast and invite your neighbors.
Yeah, I cannot wait. And, you know, we're currently outfitting our van, dubbed the USS Pancake, which is a 1997 Ford Aerostar. So we'll be sleeping in that.
I have van envy.
And, you know, of course, while we're out here still in the Pacific Northwest and going east from there, any opportunity with nice weather to camp out or to meet folks at KOA. I mean, really reach out and go to places maybe we normally wouldn't camp out if we were just doing this trip by ourselves. Take full advantage of that, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll meet some really interesting folks that are doing kind of similar projects or their own versions of America, the American tour.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be seeking out certain foods? Let's go to the food part. I know that, well, I tell you, I have done a few cross-country road trips myself, and just recently was listening to a recording that I did in 2003 where I just had my mic on and I'm driving along and it's bad audio, but I'm looking for a local burger. All over the place there are cattle ranging, and you can't buy a local burger. And I've done this trip again last year, and there's lots of local food. Mm-hmm. It's so different in just 8 years.
And a lot of the responses we get, and I went onto like a Reddit community, an online community around food, everyone's got their little local mom and pop shop. There really hasn't been like, let's go to Denny's, let's go to IHOP kind of stuff. So everyone's got these little places they really want us to visit. Mm-hmm. And as far as specialty foods, gotten a few emails from Pennsylvania where Scrapple is apparently a big breakfast item, but it's kind of funny because one of our rewards, we're doing a Kickstarter campaign to raise some of the funds for it, was to like, we'll send you a breakfast specialty item from somewhere in the country. So I'm actually looking forward to discovering some of what some of those things are, and hopefully which ones don't need refrigeration for us to send to some of our supporters.
I was visiting, my daughter in Indiana does a warm showers for bicycle tourists.
Hmm.
And I was shocked when the racing, really, you know, high racing bike guy goes to Square Donuts. You ever heard of Square Donuts? They make Square Donuts.
Mm.
And they're so sugary. But that's what he wanted for breakfast.
Interesting. Indiana's also, I think, known for their frozen custard. I remember a lot of frozen custard vendors when I was driving through Indiana last time.
It's a funny world out there.
I think also I look forward to traveling at a time when fruit will be in season, pretty much throughout the mm-hmm. entire journey. And so the idea of having watermelon in the South or having berries as we leave the Northwest is really appealing to me. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Florida where it's a whole different set of fruit, mangoes and star fruit. And avocados and, yeah, I think it'll be nice to be eating locally because you'll be in the place where corn is grown, where, where those things are local to that region.
And you get to have some varieties mm-hmm. that are not as easily transported, so they don't get marketed, but the small farmers and the farmers markets have them.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. So, are you expecting it to go? Do you have expectations? What's going to happen when? Something.
I think based on our experience thus far, and we have taken 5 people out to breakfast in Portland, and for each of those people, we've gone to a local, just a variety of different places, but Portland places, not chains. Mm-hmm. And each one of those people has had an aspect of their story which has been incredibly compelling. Sometimes it takes a few minutes for them to articulate that. Sometimes it takes a few minutes for us to understand what that is. But there is a lot of light in those conversations. And so I anticipate that it will go very well. And the most wonderful part about this has been that people have a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm to tell their story, but also just to sit down with a stranger. People want to be braver than we are made out to be.
And so it's really a social mission you have.
I think there's a lot of the social mm-hmm. mission, and it's, but if I can, and I haven't really thought this through, but it's a social mission, but it's also a personal mission for each person to say, I am not afraid of the stranger. Or I am the kind of person that would sit down to breakfast with people I don't know. And to see people enact that, mm-hmm. I find that to be probably one of the best parts of the trip thus far, or the concept thus far.
And when you're all done, you're going to have a book to publish.
We hope so.
We're going to publish the book no matter what. And, you know, at the end, if it's just self-published and we do it down at Powell's through their little printing press, then, you know, it's just a wonderful honeymoon gift to ourselves and to the folks that participated in the project.
Well, it's unique. It's different.
Well, that's a good thing for us, yeah, because we've been dating for about 8.5 years, and the idea of marriage was not always it seemed a little bit institutional. So it's been good to kind of craft it in our own personal way.
Who knows where it'll go from here?
We might be having strangers for breakfast in Europe or Asia one day.
Well, that's great. And you have a website with all sorts of information, and you blog. So anyone who wants to follow you can go there to breakfastwithstrangers.com. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that we are raising funds for this through Kickstarter. So if you're interested in this concept, you like the idea, I think we have 8 days left, and we're doing okay, but we certainly haven't been the Kickstarter phenomenon that a lot of Portland projects have been.
But you got faved by the Willamette Week.
Yeah, we did get their Kickstart My Heart section, and, you know, it's going well, and it's just a small portion of the trip to help buy in for the meals and stuff.
Yeah, we've been saving for the honeymoon for about 2 years, so we'll still do it no matter what.
Well, have a great time.
Yeah.
The wedding's going to be a snap compared to the honeymoon.
I bet. Well, and thank you for being on the KBOO Food Show. We're going to hear a little bit from Tom Waits now, Eggs and Sausage.
Nice.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Kate Welch. And if you didn't get where you can look at Breakfast with Strangers Kickstart project, it's www.breakfastwithstrangers.com. Now we're going to listen to Bruce Silverman's interview with Leo Keith. Bruce recently read her book, The Vegetarian Myth. When he first heard about her story, he was skeptical, but she had been a vegan for 20 years before she turned against it. And Leo Keith is a radical feminist and co-authored a book with Derek Jensen, who has also been a guest on KBOO. So Bruce read The Vegetarian Myth and was impressed with the depth of her research on the history of agriculture and human evolution as it relates to nutrition. He interviewed Leo by telephone in a KBOO studio.
Leo Keith, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've defined 3 groups of reasons why people become vegans and vegetarians. Could you just briefly say what those areas are and how you fell in? How many years ago was it?
Oh, I started in 1980.
What made you become a vegan?
So the three categories that you mentioned, I sort of demarcate those as there's the moral vegetarians, and this would be people who very much want to believe that life is possible without death, and especially what they would consider sentient life. So animals who are like us in some way, that we shouldn't take their lives. So that would be the moral argument. And then the second reason is the political reason, and this tends to be people who are more environmentally conscious, because a lot of the people who advocate for a plant-based diet make very compelling arguments about how factory farming, especially, is very resource intensive and very destructive, as well as being very inhumane. About that, I certainly agree, but, you know, we can talk later about whether or not animal products in themselves are, in fact, destructive or not. But what they like to propose is a plant-based diet instead. So that would be the political vegetarians, and that also, you know, has to do with resource consumption in rich countries as opposed to poor countries, and if we all became vegetarians, there'd be more food for everybody, and those sorts of arguments as well. So there's a political argument there. And then the third category would be people who are very health conscious. For almost 30 years now, our government has been telling us that the best human diet is a high-carb, low-fat diet. And, of course, I beg to differ at this point, but that's still sort of the main message that you get in the hegemony of the nutrition world. So a lot of people have taken that up. So there's people who become vegetarian or vegan for health reasons. So those are the three kind of main categories. You've got the moral arguments and then the political arguments and then the health arguments.
And for you, at least chronologically, the first thing was you didn't want to kill animals.
Yeah, and what happened for me, I think, is what happens for most people who become vegetarians, because they meet somebody who's a vegetarian and they, you know, start asking questions, and it can be very compelling. And I was only 16 years old, and I met another vegan, and so she started explaining to me all the reasons that her family was doing this, and it was very compelling. She laid out all those different arguments, and, you know, I responded to all of them. And then, as it happened, in health class, we were also learning that animal fats would kill you, essentially, and this was the message from the government, and I believe that as well. So, you know, all three of those reasons were very present in my decision to do it, but I would say that the main reason was that I really, really did not want to hurt animals. And at that time, you know, living in an urban environment, I didn't know the first thing about where my food came from. So I thought it was possible to live a life in which animals would not be harmed. So I took this up, and I took it up with a great deal of fervor, as I think most people do who, you know, are compelled by those arguments. It's a lot of moral high ground. And if you see the suffering in the world, of course, you want to do something about it. So.
Well, I'm going to jump right ahead to 1999 and later, the present. You eat animals now, parts of animals. If you're eating beef, it probably lived in close quarters with other animals. When it was killed, it was hit in the head by basically a bludgeon. How can you look yourself in the mirror after eating something like that now?
Well, the idea is that, you know, it's possible to have a life in which animals are not harmed or killed in order to sustain ourselves as humans, and that's actually a myth. It's not true. It's a fairy tale. And I wanted to believe it very badly, but life taught me otherwise. And my first inkling that this was not true was actually in a class I took in college that was called The Political Economy of Hunger. And it was co-taught by a sociologist and a biologist. And the biologist said this sentence, and I never forgot it. He said, "The moment you put a plow to soil, you destroy the soil." And I thought that by being a vegan, of course, I was, you know, saving the world in all these different ways. He walked us through that, why that's true, and I suddenly saw that the human race was on the precipice, that we had made ourselves dependent on a way of life that is actually killing the planet, and that includes animals, of course. So what is agriculture? Well, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So two big problems. One is this is mass extinction. I mean, we've had 10,000 years now of this activity, agriculture. We've trashed the planet. 99% of the old-growth forests are gone. 99% of the prairies are gone. There's nowhere left for animals to live. So 200 species go extinct every day, and that's mostly because we're doing this activity called agriculture. And then the other problem, of course, is that we're drawing down the topsoil. By 1950, the planet was pretty much out of soil, and what we've been eating instead is fossil fuel because it's gone. Every time you clear that land, it's a war. It's a war against the living world. So all those plants and animals that used to call those places home have nowhere to go, and they're gone. There used to be 60 million bison on this continent, and there are now maybe 1,200. So that's the level of destruction that this activity has caused. And I didn't know that when I chose to be a vegan. I didn't understand what agriculture was. I thought it was as simple as, what's on my plate? Was it once alive? Did its life matter? Or, you know, is it a death-free plate, i.e. only vegetables? And I didn't realize that if that plate was filled with agricultural foods, it was the death of the whole planet. So we're up against the wall now as a species. I mean, we've pretty well passed the tipping point in terms of soil, and we could back up and repair, but I just don't see that any of the institutions that are in charge are pointed in the right direction. Part of the problem is we haven't really identified the root cause of this destruction. And until people are willing to actually look at agriculture and what it is and what it's done, we're just going to keep destroying.
We have more and more people on the earth. Science is coming up with ways to grow more in the same amount of land. We have hydroponics where you don't destroy soil. We have to feed people. There's 7 billion people. It would be cruel not to feed them with whatever we can produce.
Well, the problem is nothing we do is going to feed 7 billion people. We're on drawdown. And we've been on drawdown for 10,000 years. And the first thing we started to draw down was fossil soil. We've all heard of fossil fuel, oil and gas and coal. And many people have heard of fossil water, which of course is also being drawn down by agriculture. But the very first thing that the agriculturists drew down was the soil, because it's an inherently destructive process. The moment you clear that land, it's exposed, and soil is not meant to be exposed. Just like us, it dies when it's exposed. So the sun bakes it, and the wind blows it, and the rain pounds it and washes it away. And the other problem, of course, is that without the perennial plants, without either the trees or the prairie grasses, those are the plants that have the roots that literally form the matrix that holds that soil in place. And the moment you clear that land to do agriculture, there's nothing holding it in place. So it just blows away. It drains away into the rivers, clogs the mouth of the rivers. And you can look all across the ancient world and see how many miles they had to move harbors because of all the topsoil that drained down off hillsides and clogged the rivers. You know, all around the Mediterranean, every time they dig up a site, it's, yeah, that's Ostia. It used to be 10 kilometers further toward the sea. It was a harbor. It's not anymore. It can't be, because of all the soil that literally just built up for miles. That's what agriculture is. Okay, there's no other way to do it. You have to clear that land to plant those annual monocrops. So it's inherently destructive. And like I said before, we're out of soil. So what we've been eating since the 50s is crops that are produced using fossil fuel instead. So it's oil and gas that are turned into nitrogen fertilizer because the soil is gone. There's nothing left to feed those plants. It doesn't really work to say, oh, well, there's 7 billion of us. The only reason there are that many of us is because of those fossil fuel fertilizers. And a lot of people say, you know, the year 1800 is when the Industrial Revolution really kicks off, and that's when overshoot begins. And at that point on the planet, there were 1 billion people. So the extra 6 billion are only here because of fossil fuel, because humans did something very clever and very stupid and figured out how to use fossil fuel to create more food. But I would back that up. I don't think 1 billion is really the mark, because for 10,000 years before that, the drawdown was soil. So those annual crops, they destroy soil. It's only perennial plants that build soil, so it's trees and grasses, which humans cannot eat. I'll just point out, we don't have the digestive system that can actually process cellulose into something usable.
Yeah, let's back up 10,000 years till before agriculture. What were people eating? I mean, are we eating the wrong foods? Has agriculture given us a diet of foods that we can't use?
I would say yes. And one of the strongest indications of that is that archaeologically, the evidence is quite clear. You have hunter-gatherers, and then agriculture begins in an area. And then you can look at the bones after they take up farming. And hunter-gatherers have these long, beautiful, very strong, very dense bones that are disease-free. And then people take up agriculture, and right away they shrink 6 inches. Their teeth are falling out, and their teeth don't fit anymore. And their bones are riddled with diseases. And in particular, diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, of course, are quite clear in the skeletal record, because the joints are just completely distorted, and it's very obvious. They now have autoimmune diseases that doesn't appear in the bones previous to agriculture. So it was kind of a disaster for human health as well as for the planet, and it was certainly a disaster as well for human society, because with it brings imperialism and militarism. When you're on drawdown, it's inevitable that you will have to conquer your neighbors, because if you're using up your own soil and your water and your trees, you're going to have to get them from somewhere else. So I would say across the board, it was nothing but a disaster.
Take soybeans. a wonder crop, right? I mean, this is a great industry in the U.S. Quite a good chunk of the U.S. is planted for soybeans. A minority of those beans are going directly into humans. The majority are cattle feed, which then becomes human feed. Are soybeans good for us?
No, they're not good for us, and they're definitely not good for the planet. And I can go through a list of the problems with soy. You know, the first thing being the phytoestrogens. They are endocrine disruptors. And some of the researchers will come out and say point blank, these are not foods, these are drugs. If you give an infant soy formula, that's a hormone load equivalent to feeding that child 4 birth control pills every day. Now, no parent in their right mind would do that to their infant, but we're told this is somehow healthy for this child, and it's not. And now we've got this epidemic of precocious puberty among especially girls. You know, 8-year-old girls are getting their periods. It's insane. There's no way that an 8-year-old is prepared for puberty. And it sets them up for a lifetime of suffering in terms of their reproductive lives. And I'm going to lay this at the feet of the soy industry. It's the endocrine disruptors. And it also causes tremendous birth defects as well in both boys and girls. And it's one of the reasons that vegetarian women, that the children they produce are way more likely to have birth defects. And some studies show it's 6 to 7 times as many birth defects. And the soy is one of the biggest reasons. So there's the endocrine disruptor. They also have what's called a protease inhibitors. Basically, soybeans suppress your ability to produce digestive enzymes. And this is why so many people have trouble digesting soy. You know, they'll talk about the cramping and the intestinal distress. Yeah, it's true, and that's why. Another problem is that they contain a huge load of what are called phytates. And phytates are one of the ways that plants fight back because they don't want to be eaten either. And they certainly don't want us eating their babies, which is their seeds. So seeds contain a lot of phytates. And phytates in your digestive tract will bind with minerals. So no matter how many minerals you're eating, even if you're eating like supplements or eating chicken broth or very high mineral foods, it doesn't matter. The phytates in the soybeans will bind with those minerals and just take them right out of your body so you can't digest them. And then soy also has a terrible effect on the part of your brain that's responsible for memory. There's actually an enzyme that your hippocampus has to produce for you to store memory. And soy destroys that enzyme. It blocks the production of it. Just anecdotally, the number of vegans I knew back when I was a vegan who had horrible memory problems, and I mean at age 25, I'm not talking about people who are 80. It was just terrible to watch. Now I know why, but at the time I didn't understand what was going on. Those are just some of the problems with soy, but there's a wonderful book you can read called The Whole Soy Story by Kayla Daniels. It's like 300 pages of all the stuff that soy will do to you, and also it's a big problem for your thyroid. I ended up with Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune disease of the thyroid, and I know it was from the soy because nobody in my family gets that.
Well, let's zero in on your health personally. You stopped eating meat, you became a vegan, and maybe spiritually, at least at first, you were happy with your decision. How was your health?
Well, it degenerated, and eventually it just collapsed. Long term, it just doesn't work. I pretty quickly became hypoglycemic, so I kept having to eat on a more and more frequent basis because the blood sugar swings were just so horrible. That's kind of permanent. Past a certain point, your insulin receptors just aren't going to recover. And the human body just isn't meant to absorb that much sugar. So you're on this constant roller coaster of the big insulin release to get the sugar out of your blood, and then your blood sugar crashes, and then you feel like you're going to die if you don't put something in your mouth. By the end of it, I mean, I was just eating constantly, so I didn't feel like I was about to pass out. So I have to eat a very low-carb diet now, or I'm right back into that state. You know, that can be permanent, and ultimately you get diabetic from too much sugar. That was the track I was on for sure. I also ended up with a degenerative disease of the spine. I have degenerative disc disease, and that is very common amongst people who eat, you know, heavily agricultural foods. You just don't get enough minerals. And in my case, certainly being a vegan, there was no saturated fat in my diet. Your body can't actually absorb minerals without the presence of fat, and the minerals that I was eating were being blocked by all the phytates from the soy as well. The more soy I ate, the worse my spine got. Now I can see that, you know, in retrospect, but at the time it didn't make any sense to me at all. So that's permanent. I mean, I'm always going to be in pain and have, you know, limited activity. I ended up with an autoimmune disease, and that is very tied to gluten as well. Gluten is so overdetermined in terms of giving people autoimmune diseases. So anybody who's got an autoimmune disease should really look into the gluten factor because it helped dramatically to get off gluten for me. And then there were some more minor things that actually did heal up after I stopped being a vegan. So I really did a number on my reproductive system as well, but that straightened out. When I took the soy out of my diet in particular, it made a huge difference. My sister was not so lucky. She also was a long-term vegan. She ended up with endometriosis from the soy. I had to have a hysterectomy. Yeah, it didn't do me any good in terms of my health, and I'm sort of left in the wreckage at this point. And honestly, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I know how compelling the arguments are when you're especially a teenager. And a lot of teenagers don't have the full information to be making a decision like that. And I know how terribly it ended for all of my friends were vegans or at least vegetarians. And we all had to give it up one by one. We didn't last past middle age with it because we just started to fall apart. And those of us who did it longer and more intensely ended up with some pretty bad conditions at the end of the day.
You're an intelligent person, but you didn't even connect your bad health with your diet for years and years, right?
I didn't. And that's part of the problem with extreme or even fanatical kinds of ideologies. And I say this with all due respect and even some affection. The world only changes because of fanatics. I know that. You have to have that kind of maniacal focus on one thing to shift power at all in this world. So I don't say this as an insult at all. And, you know, I still consider myself one of those people. But it's really hard to change your mind when you take on something so intensely that it becomes your identity. And that's the thing about being a vegan. I think for most of us, it wasn't something that we believed. It wasn't something that we ate. It was who we were, and it was who I was. I was a vegan. And when something becomes your identity, it is so hard to question it, because anything that threatens what you think you know about the world, whatever threatens your political framework, it's not just threatening what you think, it's threatening who you are. And I would have hated my book if I had picked it up when I was 20. I would have been terrified to pick it up. I might not have done it. And, you know, I get those emails all the time from people and those kinds of letters. Like, you know, your book sat on my dresser for 6 months. I couldn't bear to pick it up. I'm glad that they do finally read it, but I understand how hard it is. So for me, and I think for a lot of us, it's like, this is the righteous diet. It's supposed to save the world and save animals and save hungry people and make the world right. It can't fail. How could it fail? It's the righteous thing. So it doesn't make any sense. And, I've heard this story so many times. The health starts to fail, and what do? You don't look for information outside of the vegan world. You turn again to the books that convinced you in the first place, and you reread them. And that was what I did over and over. Like, every time I had any inkling that, you know, maybe the diet wasn't doing me any good, so it can't be the diet is righteous. And that was the end of the story. So it wasn't until my health collapsed completely that I was forced to take a look at it head on. But it was not a fun day, and I know how hard this is for people.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from the book.
Okay. I was told that eating those foods, those annual monocrops, would save the world. So I ate. I was always hungry, but I believed that righteousness and justice would have to be nourishment. I made it be true. Body and brain wore down day by day. To the very last hour of my vegan life, I made it be true. On that last day, I went to see a Qigong master. He had cured the incurable. He learned Qigong as a boy in China, emigrated to the U.S., endured a life of hardship. He had very kind eyes. He took my pulses, which is the basic diagnostic tool of Chinese medicine. The practitioner reads the qi, the life force, that animates the body with different vital energies to see where the patient needs help. Or he tried to take my pulses. Then he stared at me, half in awe, half in horror. There's nothing here, he said, unbelieving. You have no qi. What, I'm dead? I joked, only he didn't laugh. You are so tired, he said, unspeakably, and I also refused to say it. I couldn't. Your menstrual cycle, he asked. Infrequent, if ever, I could have added. And this problem with your spine, he said. He put his hands over my body, and it was like nothing I've ever felt. He was a sieve, and my body was water. From my head down, slowly down, he somehow filtered through my spine. He hit the beginning of the degenerating area. Oh, he said, down and still down, to the part that aches like shrapnel every waking minute. Grade 4 derangement, said the priest of radiology, reading the entrails of my bones. Oh, he said again. It was the most compassionate syllable I'd ever heard. You should have come to me a long time ago. And I knew I would leave there unchanged. He couldn't help me. Too late. What do you eat, he asked, and my heart snapped to alert. I don't eat, I began, but words were getting harder to find. I knew what was coming. I knew what I was going to have to face. No animal products. No meat, no chicken, no fish, he repeated. I nodded. I didn't want to cry. No, he said, gently and absolutely. This you cannot do. I started crying. You have some religious belief, he said kindly. I stammered. Everything was coming apart. I lived in a universe where no animals ever died for me, where my food was sustainable, where no one starved because of my unthinking cruelty or greed. None of that was true, of course, but I didn't know that then. All I knew was that those beliefs were the structural members of my identity, my daily actions, my political program, my relationship to the cosmos, and I was going to have to abandon everything and live in a universe I found repellent. I don't want to hurt any animals, I begged, like a child. The big fish eat the little fish, he offered sympathetically. But I'm not a fish, I wailed. He shrugged to say, yes, you are, we all are. But I wasn't ready to know that. All I knew was before and after, and I stood on the exact point of my life's continental divide. He knew the truth of me. I was a corpse that only moved through sheer stubborn will. My body's basic structure was caving in slowly. I was so cold my hands and feet ached 9 months of the year, and I could not have produced a baby if the entire species depended on it. He did what he could for 30 minutes, and when I left, I didn't go home. I went to the store.
Thank you for reading that. So you've said what's wrong. Do you have any solutions? How are we going to feed people?
Well, we are going to have to reduce our numbers, and this is not actually as scary as many people make it out to be. There are already 33 countries that have either stable or negative population growth. We actually know what creates overpopulation. There's really two factors that go into it, and one is poverty, and the other is the status of women. The number one thing you can do, actually, to reduce the birth rate in any country is a very simple thing. You teach a girl to read. Because when women have just that much power over their lives, they're able to exert some control over their reproductive lives, and they don't actually want to have 12 children, by and large. So when women are actually given a choice and they're allowed to make those choices for themselves, they will naturally have fewer children. And we also know why people are poor, and the reason is because the rich are stealing from them on a global scale. So we need to be against global capitalism, and, you know, we need to be against patriarchy.
This is all fine if we were all just in small villages and out in the country. There are now hundreds of cities on this earth with populations of a million and more. We can't all go out and shoot a deer or pick berries, and it will take a long time for population to decrease, even if somehow that happened earthwide. I'm going to ask you a question that I rarely get to ask, but population has been an issue for me for a long time. You said earlier, even when there were 1 billion people on the earth, it might have been still too many.
Yeah.
Pick a number. What do you think would be sustainable?
I think at this point, 300 million.
Okay, there's a number.
That number of people that we would not be drawing down anymore. I think that if we could restore the prairies and the forests, and certainly the oceans and the rivers, there would be enough abundance that we could support that many people forever. I think a billion is too many because that was agriculture that did that, and agriculture is drawdown.
Mm-hmm.
It's a destructive activity. The end was built into the beginning.
Okay, so you say fewer people. You don't like the current industrial agriculture model. What about people growing their own food? Some people do now.
I think it's a really good thing for people to do. I don't think it's going to fix any large problems, but I think it's a really great learning experience. And it's a spiritual experience as well. And for me, I had to have those kind of growth moments in my process because I didn't know how much death was involved in a head of lettuce. It wasn't until I tried to grow my own food. I mean, I was horrified by it at the time, but I didn't know what went into, you know, growing just your basic boring vegetables. It's like I had to keep killing things in order to grow food. You have to add amendments, and this was another horror for me because I go to the store and I buy the organic soil amendments, but it's all blood and bone meal, and that was a horrifying thing for me. It's like it didn't matter whether I wanted to eat dead animals. The soil wanted to eat dead animals, and the plants needed to eat dead animals, and it was just a horrifying thing for me.
Okay. Do you have a website?
So it's LierreKeith.com, and Lierre is actually Pierre with an L. If that helps, it's LierreKeith.com. The easiest thing, actually, though, is just Google vegetarian myth, and you will find me in my book.
Okay, and you will find the book in good bookstores, and I know you will find it at Multnomah County Library, where there's a long waiting list, and also at the Beaverton City Library. And the website also has some good links. Lierre Keith, I want to thank you very much for joining us on KBOO Radio.
Well, thank you for all your work. I don't know where we'd be without public radio.
Thank you, Bruce and Lierre, for that interesting interview. That's it for the June Food Show. You can listen to or download this program on the KBOO website later today. That's kboo.fm. While you're there, you can click on the Donate Now button if you haven't done it. And you can also like us on Facebook. That's the KBOO Food Show. Thanks to today's guests, Julia DeGraw, Courtney Dillard, Matt Weber, Leah O'Keefe, Bruce Silverman, and board op Kurt Lauer. Couldn't do it without you, Kurt. I'm Kate Welch. Thanks for listening, and enjoy today's long, hot start to summer. In my belly.